You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko jau toko ingoa no mai haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rapa Wednesday the 19th of October. I'm your host Joe, I'll be filling in for Amelia today and I'll be with you for the next hour. This week on the show, News and Editorial Director Jess Hopkins speaks to Brooke Van Velden in our weekly chat with the ACT Party. I'll be looking at ocean warming rates predicted to quadruple by 2090 if we don't mitigate climate change. I spoke to Dr. Kevin Trenberth from the University of Auckland on that matter. I also speak to Ariel Micah-Heswell from the University of Auckland about the toll light pollution takes on seabirds. We also have Eurovision with our European correspondent Cameron. He also brings us a piece speaking to the Radical Aid Force as well, which is an aid group operating in Ukraine. And finally, Jess speaks to Victoria University student and disability advocate Alice Mander about an independent panel that will lead a review of Aotearoa's electoral law. We have a great show for you today, so keep it on the B for the next hour. He aha whakaro, would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces. So toki pā tui mai, you can text me on 5395. Wai mai rānei or give us a call in studio on 09309 3879. Remember, you can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website. Now, let's get into The Wire for Wednesday.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with ACT Party Deputy Leader Brooke Van Velden.
Now it's time for our regular catch-up with one of our most important minor parties about the political hot potatoes of today and tomorrow. It was announced yesterday that the Ministry of Education will step in to fund Shakespeare Globe Centre New Zealand, which recently lost its Creative New Zealand funding. In a statement, Creative New Zealand clarified that they support Shakespeare being in schools, but that they can't meet the demand for funding. For our weekly catch-up with ACT Party Deputy Leader Brooke Van Velden, Jess asked Brooke why the ACT Party is against Creative New Zealand's decision.
Shakespeare Globe Centre New Zealand, who runs the annual secondary school Sheila Wynne competition, recently lost $31,000 in Creative New Zealand funding that it normally receives annually. ACT has asserted that they're trying to cancel Shakespeare, but the CEO, Stephen Wainwright, has said that the decision was more about other proposals being more important to Aotearoa. So what do you make of this reasoning?
Oh, look, I don't think that reasoning stacks up. I mean, when you look at it on the face of it, you have people within Creative New Zealand who have become activists and are pushing some form of agenda to say what they think is culturally appropriate for school kids and people of the community to be seeing and funded through Creative New Zealand. I mean, you just take two blatant examples about what has been funded and what hasn't been funded. You've got a very, very successful ongoing school competition that's about one of the largest, most popular literary greats across the globe that kids love to engage with, and the Creative New Zealand application process said had huge youth engagement and positive impacts on the participants. And that didn't get funded. And yet, on the other hand, we had something that was called the Savage Colonizer Show, which was seeking to address James Cook's fury, but that was given around $100,000. So that's three times as much money for a very different cultural context to the one that was not funded, that's hugely popular. And so you do have to ask why that was and how it's possible that the criteria didn't match up there. I think what's really important here is that members of the community love to engage with Shakespeare. It's not some form of colonization and imperialism, which is what that was quoted as. It is actually one of the greatest literary minds, and people love to engage with it. I think they really need to seriously sit down and question whether the board is making the right decisions.
So this $31,000 that Shakespeare Globe Centre New Zealand applied for, It makes up about 10% of their annual budget and was not for Sheila Wynne, but for funding an executive assistant and succession planning for the organisation. And Sheila Wynne is expected to go ahead even without this funding. So does this sort of justify, you think, why other projects who would not have survived without Creative New Zealand funding might have been prioritised?
Oh, look, I think what's more important than getting into the detail of what bits were they trying to get funded for different parts of the project, I mean, the most important part here is the application process. And it seems to me that through the application process, there have been parts of it which have looked to be an activist agenda. I mean, there's a couple of quotes here. And it's that Creative New Zealand didn't want to fund it because, quote, it has canons of imperialism. And it's, quote, not relevant for decolonising Aotearoa in the 2020s and beyond. But does that sound as though that's just they didn't want to fund it because it was for a small part of the overall competition? Or does it sound like it was part of something much larger? And I think those quotes, as part of the application process, really do point to the reason behind it.
In their response, Creative New Zealand has said that they simply couldn't meet the demand for funding and that hard decisions had to be made. We know that there is obviously a limited amount of resources for the arts. So does the ACT Party then support more funding for creative projects, and how would the ACT Party address the problems that the art sector currently has?
Look, I think there's wonderful art that does happen in our community. But I don't necessarily think all of it needs to be funded by government. What I do think is important is that when we do have government funding parts of art projects for the community, it is reflecting what people would like to see, and it's also reflecting the importance of what happens even within our education system as well. And I don't think that that has happened in this case. What we've ended up with is a board who has started to have its own agenda rather than being politically non-biased. And I think that's important to see if we're having creative art funding in New Zealand. I note that the Education Ministry actually has stepped in here to say that they don't agree with Creative New Zealand not giving funding this year, given that they'd had funding for the past 10 years. But I do think, on the whole, if we are going to have Creative New Zealand giving out money to community projects and projects that people want to engage with, that there is no bias and no activist agenda about colonisation versus decolonisation and trying to pick winners on that basis. It should be about what will get youth participation increasing and will have a positive impact on the participants. I don't think that that was the correct criteria in this case.
And you mentioned the Ministry of Education has agreed to work with Shakespeare Globe Centre New Zealand to help them through financial difficulties. So what does ACT think of this move from the government? And if it's about opportunities for young learners, does ACT think that the Ministry of Education should be responsible for funding programs like these?
Oh, look, I don't think that the Ministry of Education should be responsible for funding competitions like this. I think we've got far, far more things to be worrying about in our education system. I mean, if you look at the real basics, people are leaving school with a decreasing amount of the ability to even write and read. People who are functionally illiterate leaving our education system. And we're wasting billions of dollars every year on funding people's education, and they're leaving without the basic skills to be able to live a prosperous life in New Zealand in the 21st century. So I think we need the education system to go back to basics. I can understand, though, why they felt the need to step in this case, because it was about youth participation and youth engagement, and is about schools getting together across the country and showing what greatness there can be in looking at literacy over time and how Shakespeare has crafted the English language and how there are all these themes that are still relevant to modern day life that can be picked up through reading and writing Shakespeare and performing it. So So I can understand why they've done it, because they have such passion for it. But it's not the purpose of the education system. We do need more focus on basic education like reading and writing at schools. But funding creative projects like this should have been the role of Creative New Zealand, and I think they have failed.
Well, dozens of organisations were declined this funding, including Auckland Pride. So why did ACT then not come out in support of some of these other organisations like Auckland Pride?
Well, look, it goes back to this idea that we have applications being not progressed because of a form of activist agenda which blatantly sets out that it doesn't want to be funded because it's not relevant for decolonising Aotearoa in the 2020s and beyond. We need to get away from this idea that great literacy and great works that engage people are bad because of what country they came from or what time period they came from. If people want to engage with them and they're genuinely of interest and they stimulate young people's minds, I think that's very important. We came out opposed to this because that narrative was coming out so strong and clearly that we are being divided as a country rather than united around good ideas that will engage people for a positive future. I think the board need to sit down and justify what their criteria for funding or not funding these projects are. And I'm glad in some ways that they've put it out so blatantly that it was because of colonisation. I don't think that would be the same criteria for Auckland Pride, but I'd be happy to be wrong.
And there were four Māori-led projects that were selected for funding this year. That includes Te Rākauhua o Te Wao Tapu, Te Tairawhiti Arts Festival, Kia Mau Festival and Toi Ngā Puhi. Does the ACT Party support the funding of these projects?
I think most of the time we shouldn't be getting involved in what projects are or aren't funded. I don't know what particular types of programs, the ones that you've articulated, are. But what I don't want to see happen is that we end up with Creative New Zealand and other government agencies and entities that have public money going down a route of dividing people and having an agenda that we should be separated and trying to decolonise our country somehow through language and have some sort of activist movement against really good things that have happened and crafted language and time and history and try to artificially change the course of history for New Zealand. I don't think that's right. I think it's activist and it's inappropriate. We need to have good policies and good money spent on things that will unite people behind good ideas. And I don't think that that has happened this time. And I think the board need to seriously question why it's making the decisions it is.
That was News and Editorial Director Jess Hopkins' regular catch-up with ACT Party Deputy Leader Brooke Van Velden.
That was Deputy Leader Brooke Van Velden from the ACT Party.
And it is odd for somebody to pay you $100 for a photo of your feet. That is not normal behaviour.
The Wire.
A new comprehensive review of global ocean temperature data has allowed researchers to paint a clear picture of ocean warming since the 1950s and predict future warming scenarios. They found that if we don't take action, the rate of ocean warming will be four times larger than the current level by 2090, with dire consequences for all life on Earth. However, authors also point out that if the world succeeds in limiting global surface temperature to 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, as per the Paris Agreement, the acceleration of ocean warming will stop at around 2030, highlighting the need for urgent action to mitigate climate change. Now, I spoke to Dr. Kevin Trenberth from the University of Auckland, who co-authored the study on the matter, and I started off by asking him whether these findings were surprising.
Well, not altogether. There have been other reviews, of course, and the IPCC came out with a major report last year, and there was another one focused on the oceans and the cryosphere just a year or so before that. What this review, which was requested by Nature, is much more comprehensive in many ways, and we've had a good look at what has happened and why it has happened, and also what the implications are for the future, what the projections are for the future. And I think the numbers are a lot better refined and much more reliable than in any of the previous reviews. But yeah, we know the planet is warming, and in fact, as a part of a subset of the authors that are in this review, we have put out reports, five times the last January's, saying that the previous year was the warmest year on record for the oceans. So in January 2022, we said, 2021 was the warmest year for the oceans. And then January 2020, we said 2019 was the warmest year on the earth. And, the oceans are warming relentlessly. And so this is the main signature that the planet is actually warming, that global warming is happening, and it's mainly because of the buildup of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases in the atmosphere from human activities.
Now, your research found that ocean warming rates predict to quadruple by 2090. This will obviously have a huge impact on sea life if this does occur. Could you give me some insight into that?
Well, yeah, firstly, if you go back to the 1950s, there wasn't much warming going on at all. In fact, the warming didn't really pick up below the surface of the ocean until about the 1970s. So statements like that can be a bit misleading because, you're comparing something which is quite substantial now to something which was not much at all not that long ago. And so warming, we can actually track the warming as a function of depth. That's one of the interesting things about the ocean, and one of the reasons why it's important, because it's so ponderous and so slow to respond. And so the warming below about 500 meters really gets detected more about the 1980s, and below 1,000 meters in the 1990s. And it's not till about 2005 that we can detect the warming in the ocean down to about 2,000 meters. And so the warming keeps building up, and it provides then a warmer ocean on top of which all of the other stuff that's going on, all of the weather, El Nino events, and this leads to things called marine heat waves that cause devastation in fisheries and marine life. And so that's sort of what's been happening.
You've mentioned how the Paris Agreement falls into this, and how what they are suggesting as far as emission cuts goes could lessen the damage.
So, I mean, the context for this is, we've established sort of what has happened up until now. We have been able to show using climate models, this is more through a number of colleagues, that indeed it is caused by mainly the human contributions to changes in composition of the atmosphere. And so when we go to the future, we have to ask what if questions. What if we keep putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere at this rate? And so there have been some sort of what we call scenarios put forward as to possible future trajectories that the emissions from humans and, what we keep doing will be. And, one of them, of course, relates to trying to get to net zero by 2050. And a number of countries have pledged to do that, although at the current time, the actions to actually get there are lagging way behind. And so if we get to net zero, we can make statements about what we expect to happen with the oceans. And indeed, the oceans keep warming. And one of the consequences of a warming ocean is that it expands. It causes sea level to rise. In addition, the extra warming in other places causes the ice on land to melt. So this is Greenland, Antarctica, glaciers. And that puts more water into the ocean. And so together, those two things cause sea level to rise. And so the best single warming that the planet, best single indicator that the planet is warming is indeed changes in the ocean heat content. But the second best one, not far behind, is rises in global sea level. And of course, this affects New Zealand. It affects coastal regions. It sets the stage for larger storm surges and flooding as a consequence of that. In addition, the warm oceans then affect the atmosphere above. And right now, one of the warmest spots around the world is actually the Coral Sea. So this is off of Queensland, off of Australia, and it's one of the ingredients that has fed tremendous amounts of moisture in northeasterlies, so to speak, that as the weather systems come across Australia, and it's led to, in part, this extensive flooding that's occurred in Victoria, in Melbourne and related areas. And we've had a lot of storms come down to New Zealand that have been influenced by this. This is partly because of, you know, what we call a La Nina, that this pattern exists where it's quite cool east of the dateline across to South America, but it's quite warm in the far western Pacific around Indonesia and especially the Coral Sea. And we've seen a lot of an amazing number of storms that have developed just south of there and have come barreling down towards New Zealand. And you know, one of them went barreling right into Nelson and caused extensive flooding. Another one was a little bit farther to the west and went into Buller and caused flooding. That was a little earlier. There's been a couple of them that have just gone east of the top of the North Island and have gone into the Bay of Plenty and Taranaki, and Gisborne and Hawke's Bay. And yeah, earlier there was one that went into Taranaki on the other side. And so we've been bombarded by these storms, and they are fed in part by the very warm ocean conditions up to the north and northwest of New Zealand. And that's part the global warming, but it's also partly this La Nina pattern.
The study also found that ocean warming isn't the same everywhere, with the Southern Ocean and the Atlantic Ocean warming much faster than the Pacific and Indian Oceans. Could you tell me a bit about this and how climate change really impacts different parts of the globe?
Yeah, so certainly the global warming aspects are more uniform. But within the oceans, we have ocean currents that move heat around. And the larger warming in the Atlantic is partly because of the oceans, ocean currents that actually bring heat from the Pacific Ocean around South America and into the Atlantic, and the heat moves northwards, and some of it even goes all the way up to the Arctic. We can actually trace that. There's other aspects of it that come from the Indian Ocean that go around Africa into the Atlantic Ocean. And so the actual oceans are not warming uniformly, and this is what gives rise in part to these marine heat waves. There are some spots in the ocean that at certain times that are much warmer than the global average. And then there are some spots which are cooler. And I mentioned before that we have a La Nina right now. It's been very warm in the Coral Sea and in the even in the Tasman Sea and around New Zealand. And it's also been very warm in the North Pacific. But it's been quite cool, of course, in the tropical Pacific all the way across to South America. And this has influences on things like typhoons and hurricanes as a result.
I guess the only appropriate last question that can be asked is, how do we act on this?
Yeah, so the first thing, of course, is things related to the Paris Agreement. And number one is mitigation, as it's called. And this means cutting down on emissions, cutting down on burning fossil fuels in particular is the number one thing that needs to happen globally. And that relates also to these targets of can we get to net zero by 2050 or so? But, you know, even if we do, the oceans continue to warm because they respond very slowly and the heat penetrates slowly. And so sea level continues to rise. So it doesn't actually stop the climate change entirely. And then the second thing is to recognize that this is happening and prepare for it. So this means building resilience, assessing vulnerabilities. What parts around the coast are most vulnerable to storm surges and what low-lying areas are most vulnerable to flooding, and try to take actions, especially to manage water. Managing water turns out to be one of the key things to do as we go into the future, because there are times when we have droughts, because there's extra heat available, so things dry out quickly. We've seen that last summer, for instance, in New Zealand. But then there are times when we have too much water. And so how do we save the water from the times when we have too much for the times when we don't have enough? So this relates to waterways. It relates to reservoirs and dams and some things that people don't like to talk about, and some environmentalists don't like dams, for instance, but they actually are very useful tools for helping to manage water. And managing water is certainly going to be one of the key things as we go into the future. And so a third aspect of what we need to do is to be well informed about what is happening and why. This means continuing to have good observations and the processing of them and the understanding of what the cause is. You know, is this cause natural? Is it just a random weather event, or is it El Nino, or is it global warming? And what does the global warming add to the natural weather events? And so we have answers for all of those kind of things, but we certainly need to refine them and get better information that we can pass on to decision makers of all kinds.
That was Dr. Kevin Trenberth from the University of Auckland, who co-authored the study looking at ocean warming rates predicted to quadruple by 2090 if we don't mitigate climate change. You're on The Wire for Rapa Wednesday. We'll be right back after this short break.
Children eat worms and bugs and all sorts of things when they crawl in around.
The Wire.
Come face to face with cultural icons and discover extraordinary stories of art, love and life at Auckland Art Gallery Toyo Tamaki. Frida Kahlo and Diego Rivera, Art and Life in Modern Mexico, is the newest exhibition at the gallery. Join as a member and get free unlimited entry to this New Zealand exclusive show, so you can give them more than 150 artworks the time they deserve. Plus, get discounts, access to member-only events and more. Become a member today. Go to aucklandartgallery.com.
Deeper than underground, fresher than fresh. Every Thursday at Ding Dong Lounge, catch the next big thing before they're cool. And then enjoy being a little bit smug about it later. Playing this Thursday, The Bull's Rush, Monolith and Invasion of Piracy. Ding Dong Lounge, Auckland's Rock Dive Bar, 26 Wyndham Street. Find out more at dingdongloungenz.com.
For the best in hip, you gotta keep it green.
The hip store on K Road is what you need.
And food, and twine, books, clothes, vape supplies, and oil, and butter, drug tasting, my brother.
For the best in hip, you gotta keep it green. The hip store on K Road is what you need.
Experience the Hemp Store at 253 Karangahape Road. For nationwide delivery, visit hempstore.co.nz or call 0800 Hemp Store.
For the best in hemp, you gotta keep it green. The Hemp Store on K Road is what you need.
What's a seven-letter word for Street Fighter? No idea. I know that tonight at Ponsonby Social Club there's
Batiko Beats with Soul Bossa Duo and support from Bobby Brazuka.
And tomorrow,
DJs V and Katia.
Same old Ponsonby Social Club, 152 Ponsonby Road.
Hi, I'm Katia, and I'm running for Bird of the Year. As the only falcon endemic to Aotearoa and our only endangered bird of prey, I know a thing or two about making difficult choices and taking decisive action. Regular Kiwi mum and dad investors and other bird parents are fed up with bats, and they're fed up with bird brain seed eaters in Wellington. Vote strong this election. Vote Kariaria for Bird of the Year. Go to birdoftheyear.org.nz.
The government has indicated
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire for Rapa Wednesday. Remember, you can text us in 53955 or give us a call on 09309 3879. Let us know what you think of all the pieces you've heard so far.
Unexpectedly heartfelt ukulele performance there from Iceland.
It's Eurovision on 95 BFM with our European correspondent, Cameron Adams.
This week I spoke to our European correspondent Cameron Adams about the war in Ukraine, UK's Prime Minister Liz Truss, as well as Swiss chocolate bunnies. Here he is now. Can you give us an update on the war in Ukraine?
Yeah, up to 30% of Ukraine's power stations have been destroyed in the past 8 days, according to Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. Ukrainians are being urged to not use electrical appliances in peak times, in mornings and evenings, to save electricity. As Ukrainian presidential aide Kirilo Tymoshenko warns, quote, the entire population needs to prepare for a tough winter. Russia continues to attack civilian infrastructure across Ukraine following the recent promotion of Russian Army General Sergei Sorovikin. Just before the Crimean Bridge attack, Sorovikin, nicknamed General Armageddon, was appointed commander of all Russian forces inside Ukraine. Sorovikin was a commander for Russian forces fighting in Syria, and under his leadership saw the brutal bombing of Aleppo and Ghouta. Human Rights Watch in 2020 report has listed him as potentially having responsibility for targeting civilians in northern Syria. And the EU has delivered to Ukraine 2 billion euros of aid out of a larger package of 5 billion. Ukraine had previously criticized the EU for failing to front up with aid it had promised earlier in May.
Leaders around Europe met earlier this month to launch the European political community. What is it and why has it come about?
Yeah, leaders from Iceland to Azerbaijan met in Prague on the 6th of October under the newly formed group, the European Political Community. So French President Emmanuel Macron proposed the idea in May while holding the rotating EU Council presidency. The idea of having a larger non-binding collective of European leaders has been around for some time. Given the war in Ukraine and its effects on the continent, there was the desire between European countries to come together for talks on this issue. The quoted aims of the EPC are to, quote, foster political dialogue and cooperation to address the issues of the common interest, and, quote, strengthen the security, stability and prosperity of the European continent. So while there are different political groups within Europe, like the EU or the OSCE, which still includes Russia, or NATO, which also includes North America, there was no centralized place for only European countries to meet and discuss on these topics. It contained 44 countries, including the 27 EU member states, the recently left the UK, all of the Balkans, as well as countries further east, including Turkey, Azerbaijan, Armenia, and Georgia. Russia and Belarus were specifically not invited. It's by far not a meeting of liberal democracies or even allied countries. However, the main topics to discuss were peace and security and the energy crisis.
What was the outcome of this launch of the European political community?
Yeah, surprisingly, there were a couple of good outcomes from the summit. Going into the meeting, there was a lot of speculation it might all be hot air. So the first positive outcome was an agreement between Azerbaijan and Armenia to cooperate with an EU mission to help delineate their shared border. Since the dissolution of the Soviet Union, the two countries have had several conflicts over the disputed region of Nagorno-Karabakh. In 2020, there was a war which left thousands dead and led to a Russian peacekeeping mission. Even right before the summit in August and September, there were flare-ups again in fighting, which left over 200 dead. This is linked to a perceived weakness in Russia's ability to maintain peace. So it's a pretty significant diplomatic win for Macron and the EPC, given Russia's prior influence in the region. The mission is due to start this month and last for a maximum of 2 months, with the goal to delineate the border. And the second positive outcome was a thawing of relations between the UK and the EU. It was a gamble whether the new Prime Minister Liz Truss would actually go, especially given her previous statements about Macron and the UK's continual disagreements with the EU over Brexit. However, on the day, Truss had declared in an op-ed that, quote, it's right we find common cause with our European friends and allies. And she had also agreed to renew a UK-France summit next year. So the next summit for the European political community is due to be held in spring next year in Moldova.
On the subject of Liz Truss and the politics going on in the UK, the Prime Minister has obviously been receiving quite a lot of heat at the moment. Do you think she'll still be Prime Minister by the end of the year?
I don't know, to be honest. I don't think so. I mean, I know it's been covered before on The Wire, but yeah, I think not. You know, Kwasi Kwarteng was sacked on Friday, the second shortest term for a chancellor in British history. The shortest was Ian McCloyd, who died from a heart attack. Jeremy Hunt, Kwarteng's replacement, tears apart her budget on Monday, which calms markets but still leaves a £38 billion hole in the budget. And he's not ruling out a return to austerity. You know, Liz Truss campaigned on making unpopular decisions and pushing Trussonomics. And with that gone, what does she have? There was an interview late last night on the BBC with Liz Truss apologising for going, quote, too far, too fast. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, we'll see how she goes tomorrow in the Prime Minister's questions. And the Office of Budget Responsibility have their report out at the end of the month. Liz Truss has an approval rating lower than Prince Andrew, according to YouGov. But I don't think... I think the Tories know that if they roll her, there'll probably be a general election that she will lose. So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't think so. But, yeah, if she does get rolled, we can do a chronology and cover what will happen next.
Last matter, a Swiss court has ordered the destruction of some chocolate bunnies. Why did they do this, and was this unlawful?
No, it was totally lawful. So, Switzerland's highest court has ruled against German discount retailer Lidl's production of its chocolate bunnies. So the Swiss chocolate manufacturer Lindt claimed the bunnies were being copied and in need of protection, which the Swiss court agreed, overturning a previous judgment last year. So the court has ruled Lidl to immediately stop selling any further units and its destruction of its remaining stock. The chocolate bunnies might not totally be destroyed, however, and instead could be melted down to make something else.
That was Eurovision with our European correspondent Cameron Adams. And to the Swiss court that is destroying all those bunnies, please feel free to send them to me.
Macedonia with a reggae twist.
That was Eurovision on 95 BFM.
You're on 95 BFM. Next up, we'll stay in Europe. The Radical Aid Force is a left-wing aid group from Berlin. Since the start of the Russian invasion in Ukraine, they have been supplying aid and supplies to people and fighters in Ukraine and helping to evacuate vulnerable civilians out of the country. European correspondent Cameron Adams spoke to them about their work, including providing the morning after pill for women affected by the conflict. Here he is now.
So how did Radical Aid Force come about?
So yeah, when the war started, we all... we were friends, like the people who started the whole thing, and we all had the same idea, like right in the beginning of the war, to go first to the border and check if there's people who need a ride, or if there's, because there was lots of supplies which needed a ride to go there. And then just by coincidence, we talked and found out that we all want to do the same, and then we said, let's do it together. This is how it started. And then we met tons of people at the border, and then after a little while we realized that there's no one crossing the border, so we decided to go also into Ukraine, and this is how we got all the structure in Ukraine.
And what kind of supplies are you providing?
We had a lot of medical supplies. We got like donations from hospitals, from private persons, from pharmacies. We got some military supplies. Like, we asked people what they need. We went to a military shop, and I talked to everyone who bought, like, military stuff. Like, is it for Ukraine? If yes, we can help you bring it there. What else is needed? We can help to equip the people who are not in the army and not well-equipped. And we brought vegan food, because we met a lot of vegan people. I knew them from before the war, because of punk scene, and they were asking for vegan food. They did a vegan kitchen for free, so everyone could go there, eat for free every day. Whereas we brought a lot of animal food to the shelters.
We brought like sleeping bags and tents and stuff they need like in the front line and around this area, or for people who have no more home, where the houses got destroyed. And we brought, which is also counts as medical aid, maybe, I don't know, the morning after pill and the abortion pill for women who got raped.
Can you tell me more about the morning after pills? That was just after the liberated areas, right? In Butcher and stuff like that. How did that all work? Was it just you knew people who needed it, or was it kind of through local community groups?
There's this group, was it the Sami group? I can't remember the name. And they asked actually for this special medication. They have like a center where women can go and ask for the morning after pill. So we started to fundraise especially for this case. And I think within 2 days we got like 4,000 euros and we...
Not 4,000, but we covered almost all the costs, like 3,700 or something.
And we bought like 600, how many pills were it?
550
pills. So it was a pretty good deal because actually it's one pill is about 30 euros and we got it for
six
euros, something like this, straight from a pharmacy.
And do you still need that kind of, or do are you still kind of requested for that kind of medication or?
Yeah, a lot. Also the abortion pill, because the morning after pill, you can only take this one, which is like 40 or 24, 42 hours. And the other one is 72 hours after, when, like the time where you can take it. But sometimes it's already too late. So there's also the abortion pill, which they really need, but it's really hard to get. Because at least in Germany, it's hard to get because you have to have a doctor who is with you when you consume it, for example. And yeah, you can't just get it in the pharmacy. You need the paper from the doctor or the hospital.
Are there any kind of other kind of EU countries you could get it from easier?
It's difficult. No, not really. I mean, even passing Poland is a risk with it because we always go through Poland with a car.
Listeners may be wondering, so, you know, there's been billions of euros of aid given to Ukraine by allied countries. Why is there still the need for these kind of grassroots organizations?
Because everything which is built up there, helping people, for example, to flee the country, it's made for humans like me and Johannes, for example. We are white, we are healthy, we're young, but whoever is not white, who's, for example, black, there's a lot of people, for example, from, like, we evacuated many people from Nigeria, for example, many POC who are studying in Ukraine, and they face a lot of discrimination at the border, and they cannot use the normal, like the extra way which are provided for white Ukrainians. And also pregnant women, we help a lot because for them it's harder to flee. Then there's people with disability, like, I don't know, we took people who lost parts of their body to the war. We took families who have disabled children with autism who cannot use the train or the bus because we need to stop like every hour or whatever. Yeah, I mean, there is a lot of help and people try, but they forget people who are facing like structural discriminations. And Germany and Poland and Romania, the surrounding countries, and Ukraine too, they're all very racist countries. So especially people who are POC, for example, face a lot of discrimination here and there. So it's easier for them, for example, to cross the border if we are with them, unfortunately. As hard as it is, it's the truth, unfortunately.
There's like so much money was donated to Ukraine to big organizations. I don't know how much of this actually went where it belongs or where it needed, because most of the money is just with some rich guys from rich big
units and stuff. Yeah, there's a lot of corruption. So we know personally of many people, how do you call them? Like the head of a unit, whatever, who work for the government. They just take the money they get from the government, which they should buy like weapons for their unit. They take this money and buy guns, but sell it to other units for a lot of money, make more money out of it. So it's very corrupt. And whatever donations go to the military, like the actual military or whatever, you never know where it actually goes to. So we also help this very left-wing unit, but we know where it goes to, and we know that there's no corruption within this unit. So, but every other money it's never sure where it goes. They are everywhere, then Kiev, then Kharkiv, and southern areas too.
Somewhere. Yeah.
Yeah, Hutus clan.
How was your trip last month? That was your fifth or sixth trip, I think, to the country?
No.
We did many more.
We are not pretty good in social media, as you can see. We did, I think, 15 trips or 20 trips.
Even more, I don't know.
But the last one, when was it? It was last month. everything went fine, but on this trip we already had to face the problem that we don't have enough donations in form of supplies to fill up the full van. So we go there with a half full of van, bring donations, bring medical stuff, get refugees out. But our main goal actually is to be as efficient as possible. So have a like full van and go there and bring people out. And now we have this problem that we have no donations left. Like, yeah. We have like 5 boxes here at the moment. And it makes no sense to go this distance with 5 boxes because the fuel prices are incredible. One trip costs about 500 euros fuel. That's the main problem right now.
Why is it dropped off? Why is support dropped off, do you think?
I think people are used to the war. This is a point. Like, they're like, oh, I donated. No, it's fine. Or I read it every day in the news. It's like nothing special anymore. And people are afraid of this energy crisis, of the high prices of the gas or heating. I think this is a reason as well.
How have your trips changed since you started going to kind of now?
It changed a lot because we had to, we realized it's like not enough to just go to the border. And then if you go to Lviv, there have to be people who bring it further to the east. So we decided to do it on our own or build like a
network
to do it ourselves with other groups. And yeah, it's a lot of work, a lot of organization.
We try to not go where like the actual Russian military is, you know, like we go to different areas and we ourselves updated with people who have like a really good overview and knowledge about how this war is working and developing and where the Russians might go. So there's places we should avoid, and we're also very careful. So if one of us is going to the actual front line to deliver stuff, like this morning after pill or abortion pill, for example, we're constantly in touch, and we're constantly in touch with the person who's going, the person who are with them, and then also with people who are at their destination. So we know that they reached there, and then there's like a certain time. If we don't hear back from our person or the other way around within like 2 or 3 hours, we call all the people we know in that area. So I think ever since we built up these structures and ever since we understand the war better and seen more, it's easier for us.
And if listeners want to learn more about you guys, where can they do that?
Follow us on Instagram. Follow us on, where are we?
Twitter.
We have a GoFundMe page, do we? Yeah. Yes, we have PayPal.
If you want to like have any questions, just give us a short message, like on Instagram or an email.
Yeah.
We're always happy to answer or to work with people or whatever.
The Radical Aid Force are doing another trip on Monday, looking to fundraise around for more morning after pills, that is. You can check them out at their GoFundMe page. You're on the wire for Rapa Wednesday. We'll be right back after the short break.
Iridangi Paul, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
The Others Way Festival is just around the corner with over 30 acts of big-time musical goodness.
Featuring Anthony Tonin, The Coolies, Shafu and the Crates, Dance Exponents, Earth Tongue, Laura Jean, Mind Design and The Rear Pleasures, Pneumatics, Nadia Reid, Steve Gunn, Swidit, Te Kahu, and so much more.
95BFM presents The Others Way this Saturday all along K Road. Don't miss out. Get your tickets now from Under the Radar and flyingout.co.nz. Get your freak on this Halloween with a monstrous Saturday night on Karangahape Road.
An all-night disco bloodbath packing out Tamaki Makaurau's spookiest strip with killer parties, Halloween queens, sinister street art and twisted public performances, plus a decadent selection of delicious food and beverages.
Freak out on Karangahape Road this Halloween, Saturday, October 29th. Check out the full slate of happenings and events at karangahaperoad.com.
Motet's all set to blow with Ngā Meru Meru Bubbles.
3 days of hands-on fun and learning.
Catch a bubble, paint with bubbles, even get inside a giant bubble.
With little flick rides, food trucks, rainbow rascals and more, it's fun for the whole whānau.
Ngā Meru Meru Bubbles.
Labour Weekend, October 22nd, 23rd and 24th, 10 to 4pm at Motet.
Find out more at motet.nz.
Show Me Shorts, New Zealand's premier short film festival, is coming to cyberspace. That's right, 6 programs of fantastic short films, from whānau friendly to horror, available to watch from the comfort of your own home, or workplace, or school, or tent, or car, I guess, if you're parked up. Yeah. Down the shed, maybe, at the beach. Where was I? Show
Me Shorts.
Right, Show Me Shorts on demand, perfect for people with short attention spans. Find out more at showmeshorts.co.nz.
Wow. Music's everywhere. It's like a cloud of art.
Here at 95BFM, we've sucked up some of the best contemporary bangers, bottled them and chucked them into a special Spotify playlist just for you.
The October playlist features Jess B, Princess Chelsea, Blood Orange, Clear Path Ensemble and more.
Follow 95BFM on Spotify for our monthly Spotify playlist and stay au fait.
We don't agree with violence. We do not agree with the government! We do.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire for Rapa Wednesday. Our last piece of today's show, we'll look at light pollution's toll on Auckland's seabirds, which for the first time has been mapped in detail. It was found that the Sky Tower and CBD featured as hotspots for deaths and injuries of these seabirds. I spoke to PhD student Ariel Makaya-Heswell of Waipapatau Matarau, the University of Auckland, on the matter, and I started off by asking her about her research.
I study seabirds and sensory ecology, which is really how seabirds perceive the environment using their sense of smell, their sense of vision, and their sense of hearing. And so I look at that, and I look at threats to seabirds from their own perspective, which can include plastic pollution and light pollution, which is a huge issue for them. And so recently since last year, during the lockdowns, I found myself stuck at home with the computer, and I mapped out where all the seabirds were landing from light pollution. And yeah, that's practically got me into a lot more into the light pollution aspect and figuring out where they were landing there, why they were landing there. And yeah, we discovered some really cool results and correlations out of it.
Now, it says here that the most groundings were in the CBD, which makes sense because that's the place with the worst light pollution. Is this surprising to you?
This isn't that surprising because usually from some other research around in different areas, such as in Hawaii and the Canary Islands, the researchers there have suggested that areas with higher light pollution do have more seabird groundings, and even if it's by a light, a street lamp and buildings. And we're seeing that here in Auckland, considering Auckland is a major, the Hauraki Gulf, is a seabird hotspot, and Aotearoa is a global seabird hotspot with all these breeding seabirds in the Hauraki Gulf. And many of them, especially the Cook's petrels, fledglings, during March to May, they are crossing over the Auckland Isthmus to go to their foraging grounds in the Tasman Sea. And many of them succumb to the light pollution and the street lights. And yeah, especially the CBD with all that intense buildings and higher light pollution and intensity of light pollution, it's more attractive and disorientating for them, which leads to greater groundings.
April was the worst month due to the birds' migration patterns. Could you tell me a bit about this?
Yes. So during April, that is when especially young Cook's petrels, they're starting to take off for the first time. So they're starting to leave their burrows. And as they fly across Auckland to the foraging grounds in the Tasman, especially in April, this is when they're doing their crossover, and they are more susceptible to light pollution. And that's what I mean when April is really the worst month, especially for the Cook's petrels.
the greater the light pollution, the greater the likelihood of these groundings due to, I guess, an intriguing question would be, how do we address this?
Well, we can also look at examples from other places around the world, such as in Vancouver and Singapore, where they employ some mitigation strategies to try and just figure out the intensity of the issue and also try and reduce it. For example, in Singapore, they have the workers and even just members of the public are encouraged, if they see a dead bird from light pollution, they are encouraged to note it down and then they report it to their database. And so at least we get a recording as to where they're falling out. And also some studies have showed that even changing some changes in lighting type could have an effect and reduce the seabird fallout. But also it could be something as simple as just closing curtains, maybe having a bit more blackout curtains, and closing office blinds, turning off lights when you know you don't need to use it, especially in like those apartments and CBD offices. Just just close, if they have blinds and light and curtains, just shutting them, just to help with the reduce the light pollution.
Now, you've also put forward the Titi, or the Cook's Petrel, for Bird of the Year as well. Bird of the Year is quite a tight competition this year. So, yeah, I guess, tell me a bit about the Cook's Petrel and why you think it deserves to be Bird of the Year.
Yes, well, Cook's Petrels, they actually resemble a seagull in terms of their color, but actually they're quite different. They've got a white underbelly, these gray wings with a little M feather mark on their back, and these cute little black bills, and they're quite chubby looking, and they often waddle around. And because they, since between 2018 to present day, that includes data from this year, over 400 of them have been brought into bird care Aotearoa from light pollution, which is a huge issue. And this is increasing every year. We've seen since 2021, there was approximately about 100 which came into bird care. But this year alone, we've had 150 come in, so almost like and so it has been increasing over the years. And so just to raise awareness to help and try conserve these little seabirds, is just to, yeah, that's our hope and plan for the Bird of the Year, because light pollution is very susceptible to light pollution, and also they breed in the Hauraki Gulf right next to Auckland, which is a seabird hotspot. So really important to get that message out there for Bird of the Year. And also, we've never had a seabird win Bird of the Year before, such as like an albatross or a petrel or a shearwater. So I think it's time to get a little Cook's Petrel in for the running.
That was PhD student Arielle Makaya-Heswell of Waipapatau Matarau, the University of Auckland, speaking about the toll light pollution takes on Auckland's seabirds. Side note, I highly recommend everyone get out there and vote for Bird of the Year as well.
That was The Wire.
Kia ora te hautaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, me te mihi ki a koutou katoa, e kororo, mau kia mō tēnei rā. That is a wrap on the Wednesday Wire. Thanks to everyone who spoke with us today. Thanks to my producer, also the news and editorial director, actually, Jess Hopkins, who spoke to Brooke Van Velden of the ACT Party, Dr. Kevin Trenberth from the University of Auckland, Arielle Makaya-Heswell, also from the University of Auckland, as well as our European correspondent, Cameron Adams, and the Radical Aid Force. Neda hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You are listening to 95 BFM. I will now pass you on to the wonderful with Bridge. A te wā.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.